The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled When Bad Things Happen to Good People, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmos Tovia Ben Shlomo Verezel Bas Label Aleichem HaSholem, Mr. and Mrs. Ted and Rose Burstyn of blessed memory.
Probably the most difficult, if not the most ancient, of questions asked by man was, how is it that bad things happen to good people? As Rabbi Chopnik pointed out, this is a question that Moshe Rabbeinu asked. Moses himself asked the question to God. The answer we're going to, as the night, at least how the Talmud interprets what that answer was. But in order to deal with the problem of suffering, we first have to understand the basic philosophy of Jewish life. And then after we've laid the foundation, we'll proceed to the idea of suffering. In fact, this lecture will really consist of three parts. One will be the basic idea, the basic philosophy of Judaism, you know, as it relates to suffering. Second, we will go through specific types of suffering, and then I'll open the floor to all your questions. As you notice in the handout, there are two groups of words. The first group spells out the acronym SPIRIT, and the second spells out the acronym TRUST. And I thought, for learning purposes, each one represents a different part of this lecture, so hopefully if you look at it enough times, you'll remember the lecture. One of the most basic tenets of Judaism is that we have a soul. In other words, you ask, what is the real you? You close your eyes and say, well, it's not my hands, it's not my feet. Like, what part of me is the real me? And the Jewish point of view is that me is a soul. It's a spiritual entity. It occupies the body. And when the body no longer functions, it leaves the body to another realm. Something akin to, make the analogy to how you drive your car. Go into your car, open up the door, you sit in, close the door hopefully, you strap yourself in, you turn on the ignition, you put your foot on the accelerator or the brake, or the accelerator and the brake, and you keep on going. When you are driving, you are tied to your car. When you finish, you park your car, you unstrap yourself, take the key off and onto the accelerator, out of the ignition. You leave your car and you have a life of your own. While you're in the car, you only function with the car. But you have the ability to function outside of your car. This is, we think, just that analogy in terms of how Jewish tradition looks at the body versus the soul or the mind. The soul, your consciousness, exists outside of your body. This is an idea very basic to Judaism. Just give you just one small biblical example. One of the most fascinating stories in Navi, in the historic prophets, is recorded in the first book of Samuel, Shmuel Aleph, in Perek Chof Ches, in chapter 28. Here, the king, says Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, is about to fight the last battle of his life. The Philistines are in battle array. He has to meet the enemy on the morrow, and he is frightened. And he wants some divine guidance as to know what to do. And he goes to a balas ov. He goes to a medium, a channeler, someone who speaks to spirits. In the village of Ein Dor, he disguises himself. He wants to speak to Shmuel, Samuel the prophet. And there's a whole long narrative how Shaul HaMelech speaks to the deceased soul of Shmuel. Evidently, the writer of these words believed in life after death. It's an idea which is central to the whole Talmud. What's very interesting is in the last 20-25 years, there is a whole literature that has been published by researchers of note to add evidence to that which was always part of Jewish tradition. I'll just give you just one small example. And I think it's really, if you're really interested in pursuing the subject, there are some many, many, many fine books on the subject. In 1975, a small book was printed. It became an overnight international bestseller. It was written by Dr. Raymond Moody, and the name of the book was Life After Life. It was so successful, he wrote a sequel the next year, Reflections on Life After Life. I believe he was a cardiologist, and because of his occupation in this field, he left cardiology entirely and devoted himself to research in this field. He wrote a sequel in 1988 called The Light Beyond, which he speaks not only of his own research, but already of the cumulative research that occurred throughout the years. Now, if you... I'm sure most of you have read something about the near-death experience. Those who've been like at death's door, so to speak, they have a sense, I mean, they are basically comatose, and they have a sense that their consciousness left their body. Very often they're hovering over the body, they're looking at the lifeless body below. Very often they go beyond this stage and claim to have gone to the world beyond and to have experienced an unspeakable joy of the experience of the next world. It's very hard to verify reports about the next world. The credence one can give to that evidence, of course, is by the fact that people of various lifestyles, religions, educational backgrounds, cultural and national backgrounds have virtually the same story. There's been recently a book that dealt with over 100 case studies of little children who had near-death experiences. These are kids who, in all probability, were never exposed, at least to the recent literature, didn't go to Sunday school yet, and yet they have the same claim. But there are certain claims by these people that can be verified. Let me tell you the following incident. There was a woman, this is described in Dr. Moody's book of 1988, The Light Beyond. There's a woman by the name of June, and she was very, very sick, and she was on the operating table, and she claims that she felt her consciousness leave her body. She looked around while they were operating on her. Evidently, you've seen one operation, you've seen them all. It was getting a little boring. So she decided to go to the next room. She went across the hall. At least this is her claim. No one saw her go. But her claim is she went across the hall and went into the waiting room across the hall where her brother-in-law happened to be sitting. And she picked up, you know, as she was there, she saw her brother-in-law happen on to, you know, bump into an old friend. And they started talking. And the friend asked the brother-in-law, hey, what are you doing here? You know, and the brother-in-law replied, you know, it looks like my sister-in-law, June, is about to kick the bucket. And I had to cut short my fishing trip because it looks like I'm going to be one of the pallbearers. Well, June heard enough. She went back to her room.
Oh, yeah?
And that's according to her start. And she survived the operation. When she came to in the recovery room, the first words that she uttered to her brother-in-law happened to be there. But next time you want to go on a fishing trip, just go right ahead. I'll be just fine. And it looked like the brother-in-law was going to have a near-death experience. The first idea we're positing is that is basic to Judaism, that there is a soul, there is a consciousness beyond the body. So that's the S of the acronym SPIRIT. That's the S, soul. The next idea is purpose. It's basic to Judaism that there is a God who designed, who created this world, and who created man with a purpose. And what seems to be the consensus of the Mekubalim, of the Kabbalistic thinkers, is the purpose that God created man was in order to give man pleasure. Olam Haba, the next world, is described in terms of this is Ein Shom Lo Yachirav Lo Shtir, there's no eating or drinking. El Tzadikim Yoshvim, the saints are sitting. Vitraseim Breshem, their crowns are on their heads, the spiritual crowns. The Nenim Meziv Hashkina, they're having pleasure from the splendor of the divine presence. There's another medrash, though, that right before a person dies, a person may experience a divine presence. I mean, it's a relatively short-lived experience, but a person, the divine presence comes to greet him. I think you're giving him a taste, like we have a Shabbos, which is a taste of the world to come. It's like a little bit like a Shabbos. Person leaves the world, there's a taste of what ultimately is in store for him. I'd like to read to you a description of what seems to be the same phenomena which is described in the rabbinic writings in Chazal. This is in Dr. Moody's first book. I knew I was dying, and there was nothing I could do about it because no one could hear me. I was out of my body, there's no doubt about it, because I could see my own body there on the operating table. My soul was out. All this made me feel very bad at first, but then this really bright light came. It did seem that it was a little dim at first, but then it was this huge beam. It was just tremendous amount of light. Nothing like a big bright flashlight. It was just too much light. And it gave off heat to me. I felt a warm sensation. It was a bright yellowish white, more white. It was tremendously bright. I just can't describe it. It seemed that it covered everything, yet it didn't prevent me from seeing everything around me, the operating room, the nurses, the doctors, the nurses, everything. I could see clearly, and it wasn't blinding. At first, when the light came, I wasn't sure about what was happening. But then it asked. It kind of asked me if I was ready to die. It was like talking to a person, but a person wasn't there. The light was talking to me, but in a voice. And I think the voice that was talking to me actually realized that I wasn't ready to die. You know, it was just kind of testing me more than anything else. Yet from the moment the light spoke to me, I felt really good, secure in love. The love which came from it is just unimaginable, indescribable. It was a fun person to be with. And it had a sense of humor too, definitely. I'd like to share with you, though, a more somber description of this. Because different folks, different strokes, you know. There was a recent book that was published, also a bestseller. Fascinating book, and in a sense it's also a must read. And it was written by a doctor who's the head of psychiatry in Mount Sinai Hospital in Miami, Dr. Brian Weiss. And the name of the book is Many Lives, Many Masters. And we're going to touch upon that book a little later this evening. But this woman, under hypnosis, described how it felt to die in a previous life. I just bring this for this passage here. And she's describing it. For now I just feel the peace. It's a time of comfort. The party must be comforted. The soul finds peace here. This is a woman again who's speaking in an hypnotic state, reliving that past. You leave all the bodily pains behind you. Your soul is peaceful and serene. It's a wonderful feeling. Wonderful, like the sun is always shining on you. The light is so brilliant. Everything comes from the light. Energy comes from this light. Our soul immediately goes there. It's almost like a magnetic force that we're attracted to. It's wonderful. It's like a power source. It knows how to heal. This is her description of the light, which seems to parallel Chazal's description, the rabbi's description of the Shekhinah coming to a person at the time of death. That experience, and evidently it would seem to be this is a taste of the ultimate experience, is what God created the world for. The purpose, according to the consensus of the Kabbalah, of the Kabbalists, is that God created man to give man pleasure, to give him. The pleasure really comes from being close to him, that feeling of one with God. But if God created man to give him such pleasure, why didn't he create man originally in such a state? Why is it that one would have to live a life first in order to reach that state? So this takes us to the next letter. We went through the S of spirit, which is soul, the P, purpose, and now I, which is investment. One of the most fascinating works that came in the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance period, was a book written by the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo. And the name of the book is Magid Meshorim. And it describes, written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, it describes his communications by a spirit master. And this otherworldly intelligence was his teacher. And in Kabbalistic literature, this is not all that uncommon. The book is divided up into the parshas of the Torah. In Parshas Bereishis, the portion of Bereishis, there is a communication there that this malach, this angel, this intelligence, communicates to him and tells him about why man was created on this earth. And that's why was he, again, not created originally in a state of bliss, but rather to go through this world. And his answer, which has become basically a classic in late rabbinic literature, is that it should not be nahama dikisufa, the bread of shame. In other words, that which we experience is something that we made ourselves. It's ours. It's not a handout. We're not on welfare. We earned it. We deserved it. It's basically as if God put us far away from him and we have to make the walk, the trek to him. He didn't place us next to him. He says, I want you to appreciate that experience. I want you to make it yourself. I want it to be your own. And in essence, we create the relationship with God. It isn't imposed upon us, but to a great degree, we create that relationship. And the purpose of life is that we are basically given raw material. Just as a sculptor is given a slab of marble, and he has to take that slab, which has a tremendous potential, but has to etch it and polish it, design it, so it comes out to the final sculpture. That's what really life is all about. We take from it to the extent that we invest into it. Hence the word investment. So here we have then the third idea, the eye of spirit, investment. Again, just again another parallel to this idea in this book by Brian Weiss of Life After Life, how she describes this woman under hypnosis. Our task is to learn to become godlike through knowledge. We know so little. By knowledge we approach God, then we can rest. And she continues on another conversation, in a snippet in the middle, of, only we can rid ourselves of the bad habits that we accumulate when we are in a physical state. And it's only when you decide you're strong enough to master the external problems, in other words, you've massaged yourself, you've corrected your, then you will not have them in your next life. And this is something we're going to come on to. But really, the purpose of life is to recreate yourself. There's a statement made by the famous Gaon of Vilna, who passed away a little over 200 years ago, who in a collection of his sayings, it's a work called Eben Shlema, in the third chapter, he says that the purpose, is a statement, is the purpose of a man's stay on earth is lesaken midosav, is to correct his character. And if he's not busy correcting his character, lomaloi chayim, so what is he doing alive? There's really no right to be here. I mean, basically, it's like you give the sculptor the slab and he does nothing with it. Or worse, he ruins it. Your purpose is to be, to fix it, to design it, to polish it, catch it into something beautiful. So the third letter of this word spirit is investment. The fourth letter is the word reincarnation. It's a basic tenet of the Kabbalah. It's something which is mentioned many, many times in the Zohar, which is the classic work of Kabbalah, that there is a notion of reincarnation. This is alluded to oftentimes by the Ramban, one of the great medieval commentators. And it is, since basically the Kabbalah has been widely accepted by the vast majority of rabbinic thinkers, it is really a notion which is mainstream. That we may come back again. The idea of reincarnation is not merely something which is in the Kabbalah, or it's part of the Eastern tradition, the Hindu and Buddhist tradition, Jainist tradition. But there is an enormous amount of evidence to support the idea of reincarnation. I'd like to share with you a typical story. There was a girl, Kumari Shanta Devi, born October 12, 1926, in Delhi, daughter of B. Rang Bahadur Mathur. From the age of about four, she began to speak of a former life of hers in Mutra, a town about 100 miles from Delhi, saying that she was then a Chobin by caste, that her husband was a cloth merchant, that her house was yellow, etc. Later, she told a grand uncle of hers, Mr. Bishan Chand, that her husband's name in her previous life had been Kedar Nath Chaudhi. The uncle mentioned this to Mr. Lala Kishan Chand, M.A., a retired principal, who asked to meet the girl. She then gave him the address of Kedar Nath, to whom he wrote. To his surprise, it turned out that Kedar Nath Chaudhi actually existed. And in his reply to the letter, he confirmed various of the details Shanti Devi had given and suggested that a relative of his in Delhi, Tanji Mal, interview the girl. When he came to see her, she recognized him as a cousin of her former husband and gave convincing replies to questions of his concerning intimate details. Kedar Nath Chaudhi then, on November 13, 1935, came to Delhi with his present wife and his 10-year-old son by his former wife. Shanta Devi recognized Kedar Nath and was greatly moved, answering convincingly various questions asked by him about private matters of her former life as his wife, and mentioning that she had buried 150 rupees in a certain room of her house in Mutra. After they left, she kept on asking to be taken to Mutra, describing various features of the town. On November 24, 1935, she and her parents and three inquirers who author the pamphlet that describes the story went to Mutra. Those who wrote the pamphlet, one was a leader in the Nationalist Party, this is Mahatma Gandhi's party. One was a managing editor of the Daily Tej, and one was an advocate. On the railway platform, an elderly man and the group of people there paused for a moment in front of her, and she recognized them, saying that he was her Jeff, the elder brother of her former husband. And they could see, Mechutin, you know. The party then took a carriage whose driver was instructed to follow whatever route the girl told him. She mentioned that the road to the station had not been asphalted when she lived in Mutra. My things have changed. And she pointed out various buildings which had not existed then. She led the party to the lane in which was a house she had formerly occupied. And then she moved later before she died. In the lane, she met and recognized an old Brahmin whom she correctly identified as her father-in-law. She identified the old house now rented to strangers. Two gentlemen of Mutra, this is very significant, who then joined the party, asked her where the Jai Zarur of the house was, a local expression which the party from Delhi did not understand. She, however, understood it and pointed out the privy, which in Mutra that term is used to designate. In other words, here were these three very educated gentlemen who did not know the local dialect. And here is this 9-year-old girl who's never entered Mutra, who was able to converse with these people in the local dialect. After leaving the old house, as she led the way to the newer, still occupied by Chaudhry Kedar Nath, she recognized her former brother, now 25 years old, and her uncle-in-law. At the house, she was asked to point out the well she had mentioned in Delhi. There is now no well in the courtyard there, but she pointed out the place where it had been. Kedar Nath then lifted the stone, which had since been covered. She then led the way to the room she had formerly occupied, where she had buried the money. She pointed to the spot which was then dug up, and about a foot down, a receptacle for keeping valuables was found, but no money was in it. Kedar Nath Chaudhri later disclosed that he had removed it after death of his first wife, Lugdi, at the age of 23, on October 4, 1925, following the birth of her son on September 25th. Later, Shanta Devi recognized her former father and mother in a crowd of over 50 persons. The pamphlet reproduced also the confirmatory testimony of Kedar Nath's cousin in Delhi, Chaudhry Kenji Mal, including a statement of the questions he asked Shanti Devi when he interviewed her and of her replies. This is by no means atypical. I'm just giving you an example of a vast literature of reincarnation memories. The idea of reincarnation is very much also part of Jewish tradition. So we have S, soul, P, purpose, I, investment, R, reincarnation, and now we have I, which was inquiry. It's interesting that in Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, describing the experiences with this being of light, you know, this great light, he quotes from one person, the thing he said to me was that he kind of asked me if I was ready to die, or what I had done with my life that I wanted to show him. In another case here, the voice asked me a question, is it worth it? And what it meant was that the kind of life I'd been leading up to the point seemed worthwhile to me then, knowing what I then knew. There seems, very often, at least the description of Dr. Moody's, at least again, this is not true death, the people did not die, this is just the first stages of the dying process, that there is really an inquiry. In other words, you're asked, what did you do with your life? This is a theme, by the way, which also is in Dr. Brian Weiss's book. Dr. Brian Weiss's book is an unusual book in that not only do we have vivid reincarnation memories, but at least the claim of the woman under hypnosis was that she is communicating with these master spirits who are telling her information which basically is in other words is very much like the message of the Torah. And she keeps on, and in this, in her hypnotic states, I'll just give you one example here. We have debts that must be paid. If we have not paid out these debts, then we must take them into another life in order that they may be worked through. You progress by paying your debts. Some souls progress faster than others. When you're in a physical form and you're working through a life. If something interrupts your ability to pay that debt, you must return to the plane of recollection. In other words, this is the plane that when the person dies, his whole life is reviewed. And there you must wait until the soul you owe the debt to has come to see you. Then you both can be returned to physical form at the same time. Then you are allowed to return. And it's a common, we're going to touch upon it later on, it is a common theme, the idea of you're coming here to fix yourself up. And if you didn't, you have to go through this whole process of reviewing your life. What did you do wrong? What can you do better next time? You know, it's like halftime of a football game. Now, this is the I for inquiry. In the beginning of the third chapter in Pirkei Avos, there is the statement that a person should keep in mind. And this is Atavi ben Mahalal Alamer, that a person should keep in mind three things and will not come to sin. And one of them is Lifnei Mi'at Osed Lipein Din Bakeshem. From whom will you have to give an accounting? There is an accounting. Because basically, from all our sources, and this is a tradition of the Torah, we are here for a purpose. And that purpose is to perfect ourselves. And just like, again, the analogy with the sculptor and the slab of marble. And if we don't perfect ourselves, we have to give an accounting. Why not? And perhaps, again, this is one instance, but perhaps we have to be sent back again to try it again. There's a fascinating comment from again from the Vilna Gaon in this commentary on the book of Jonah. Here he explains a very puzzling verse in Kohelis, in the fourth chapter of Ecclesiastes. Toivim hamesim asher mesu. Better are the dead asher mesu who have already died. Menachayim asher chayim adena. Than the living that are still alive. It's better the dead who have died than the living that are still alive. The redundancy is evident. The Vilna Gaon explains this to me. In theory, a person is to comes down to this earth to perfect himself. In other words, to earn, as we said, that experience being close to God, and he has the program that God has planned for him. He's missed something. He hasn't done it all. If he doesn't, this is the last, theoretically, this is the last moment of his life he could fulfill it. Or perhaps, maybe it's best that he shouldn't fulfill it and come back again. Imagine if he has another lease on life, look how many more mitzvahs he could do. Look how much Torah he could learn. This is really the same problem as one is on a winning streak in Las Vegas. You know, if you hit the same number on a roulette wheel, keeps on winning and winning, when do you stop? The Vilna Gaon explains, Toivim hamesim asher mesu. Better the dead who have stopped dying. They're finished. It's over. Menachayim asher chayim adena. Then the living that are still alive, they have to come back a second time. In other words, stop while you're ahead. With this, the Vilna Gaon also explains a very difficult passage in the Talmud. This is more in Erev and Yudgimel on the Beis in 13b, where it cites an argument between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel, that for 2.5 years, they were disagreeing on the point of Toiv or Noyach Loil Odom Shenivra Mishaloyniv. Is it better for a person to have been created or not to have been created? After 2.5 years of argumentation, Nimnu v'gomru, they came to the conclusion, Toiv lod, noyach loy lodom shaloynivra, best that he is not created. The achshav shenivra, but now that he is created, yamashmish v'maisav, yafashmish v'maisav, a person should do introspection, a person should look into his deeds. On the surface, it's a very difficult passage. It doesn't mean it's better for not to be, God created you, evidently, you know, it must be the best thing. If he did it, it must be good. Who are we to second-guess God, so to speak? There are many different interpretations, of course, on this passage. But the Vilna Gaon, using this paradigm, explains as follows. They were speaking in code language because the mysteries of the Kabbalah were not transmitted to the vast public, but was really only for a select few. The true meaning was, but they were arguing about this point, is it better to stop while you're ahead or to come back again? And after 2.5 years, they came to the conclusion it's best to stop while you're ahead. But now that you're here a second time, and you don't have a recollection of what you did wrong in the past life, what should you work on? What were you here for? So the yamashmish v'maisav and the yafashmish v'maisav, the introspection, the person looks at his weaknesses, that a person has a predisposition to certain vices, that's what you came for. If you found that your makeup has these weaknesses, evidently that's what you're coming for, that's what you messed up the last time, that's what you're here to fix up this time. But life then, again, is the purpose of life is really to work. We're here to work. Hayom la'asosam. This time, this era is to work. U'b'machol l'kabel shkoram. The next world is, the next phase of existence is to reap the rewards. Of course, we don't demand, we don't impose, we're not getting to the suffering yet. This is just as an overview of the Jewish philosophy of life. We don't necessarily demand everyone should make it difficult, you know, you should work until you drop. Perhaps the best analogy would be is how we view the workplace. If you ask somebody who's dedicated, who's been a success in his job, has built a company, and has a beautiful family, has acquired beautiful acquisitions, and you ask him, where do you have your real pleasure? At work or at home? I mean, depending, some people just enjoy the challenge of the work. The people who normally, you know, they work and they enjoy, you know, their home life. And at that point, well, my enjoyment is my home. It's my wife, my kids, family. You know, and I really enjoy when I have vacation time. Then we can really spend time together. We can go out. We can enjoy ourselves. That's enjoyment time. But you work in order to earn, you know, the ability to pay for, you know, to pay for your home, I mean, car or yacht or vacation. But yet, even though we can compartmentalize this part of my life is a work, and this part is enjoyment, yet for maximum productivity, we tend to try to make the workplace as enjoyable as it can be. But the enjoyment or the ambiance of the workplace is only to enhance the productivity. It's not for it itself. You know, just as an aside, there have been many articles written about a very interesting phenomenon. If you buy a program with Windows on your computer, it automatically comes with Solitaire. And they have found that an inordinate amount of time is spent by the employees playing Solitaire while there should be working. I mean, there's a whole problem to should eliminate it from your, you know, when you get the Windows package, to eliminate the whole games program. It's a whole... there are those who are quite crafty workers who really have a fake screen, so to speak, that they're busy playing Solitaire. When the employer comes in, they press one button and it looks like a spreadsheet. Because business is not the time to play. You can play Solitaire at home on your home computer. You're there to work. We want to make the workplace as pleasant as they can, and depending on the workplace, there may be plush carpeting, there may be pictures, there may be piped in music, but it's only to enhance the work. Because the business at hand is productivity, work. The enjoyment is after hours. Just the same parallel really is the relationship of how we view life and the afterlife. This life is to work. The afterlife is to enjoy. But we try to make this life as comfortable to maximize the work, but not to the detriment of the work. That really probably would be best described the Jewish attitude of enjoyment in life. The last of our spirit, remember that. And the last, the T, is time limit. When Mashiach comes, the buzzer will sound. And it's all over. It's like musical chairs. When the music stops, either you're sitting or you're not sitting. In the Jewish view, reincarnation does not last forever. So even if one say, well, you know, it's nicht so gefährlich, you know, it's not so bad, well, I mess it up one time, I'll try it again, you only have a limited amount of chances. And there's a final judgment day. So T is time limit. This is the din, this is Tekabisha, this is by the Tekia Shefer, there's going to be a Tekias HaMesim, and there's going to be the Yom Gadol V'Noir will be this awesome day of judgment. That's the first part of this lecture. Now we're going on to the second part. So we explain the first part, meaning that this is the basic philosophy of Judaism. You should have learned all of this in Talmud Torah, because you cannot practice Judaism unless you know this. Because it really doesn't make any sense otherwise. Why should you keep Shabbos? Or why should you keep kosher? Or why should you do anything if it really doesn't make a difference anyway? When you die, it's all over. I was by a shiva call, and I was sitting with someone of our community in Detroit. He was very angry at a conservative rabbi who was a neighbor in the neighborhood. Because he was supposed to say that his brother had died, and this conservative, his parents are not belong to this conservative temple, and he was supposed to officiate. And you see, he was having problems with his officiating at the service. And the reason he gave was that sometime before, a friend of his was also in a similar situation and lost a sibling. And the friend asked the rabbi, tell me, Rabbi, what happens when you die? And the rabbi answered, nothing. It's over. That's it. A person lives in our memories. This is the same one that chants by every Leviathan, the Gan Eden Tei Menuchasa. In other words, in Gan Eden, may his resting place be. But it's a person who really doesn't believe in it. But if you really don't have this belief, the whole structure really makes no sense. Because it really doesn't make a difference. If you're good, you're bad. Because it really doesn't make a difference. If you're good, you're bad. What difference does it make? The only reason a person would do any of this, it makes them feel good. If you feel good playing golf or doing something else, so do it. Because it doesn't make a difference. All of Judaism only makes sense in a framework that there is life after death, and there is a purpose, and there is an inquiry, and there is an accountability, and it makes a difference how you lead life. So the question, how am I supposed to lead the life? And that's what we have Torah for, which is a guide of how to live life. But if we don't have, this is just basic. In other words, really, if you would ask a bright kid, a Chassidish yeshiva, they'll tell you everything I told you. Yeah, maybe that'd be pretty bright, but basically this is, I haven't told you any, there's no surprises here. Maybe they don't know about the story about Shanta Devi, but they do know about reincarnation, They may not know about the great lights or the near-death experience, but the basic idea is part and parcel of Judaism 101. That's the first part of our lecture. The second part of our lecture is, in the light of all of this, how do we understand suffering? And as we put this again, and the acronym here is TRUST. There are different parts of the suffering experience. We can't label them, all suffering is the same. There are different parts to the experience. The T is we use as therapeutic. Very often, people have to be shocked. They live a whole life in the lap of luxury, very selfish, and then some terrible incident happens to them. And they have to start groping. What's life all about anyway? They never started thinking yet. The suffering is something which is a, excuse the expression, but like baptism by fire. Because they never come to grips with themselves. It's like shock therapy. So very often, the idea of the of suffering is God's way of just tapping you on the shoulder. What happens if you try to tap somebody on the shoulder and he has an insensitive shoulder? Right? And it's important because maybe he's double trafficking, he's in the middle of, and he's holding up traffic. Maybe there's going to be a whole accident because of him. And you try to keep on tapping him on the shoulder and nothing happens. So you take a hammer and start banging him on the shoulder. Then you better get attention or there's a lot of people that may be hurt because he's double parked. Right? So one purpose of suffering is really part of like shock therapy. Then he has to rethink life. You know, what's unfortunately what very often happens, and really this is all part of a therapy, very often happens, people, even though they may be very selfish, very self-centered, very narcissistic, you ask them, what kind of a person I am? I'm a great person. Wonderful person. And then if Chas v'Shalom, some tragedy happened to them, why did it happen to me? Like, I'm so worthy. Because unfortunately, sometimes people need a shock to examine what life is all about. So the first T is therapeutic. The R is refinement. The R could also be retribution. In Kabbalistic terms, when we do something wrong, we are doing two things. We are doing, the actual thing is wrong, in intrinsically the act is wrong. In the Kabbalistic sense, that there is a whole spiritual world. And let's say, for instance, a person does something which is wrong. Let's say something which is clearly, it's not a debatable point. Let's say it says clearly in the Torah that one cannot eat meat, you know, of a non-ungulate. In other words, you can't eat pig's meat. It's something that's clear in the Torah. It's not something we can debate on. In Kabbalistic terms, it's not merely a question of health or merely a question, well, you're defying the will of God. God told you not to do it. You know, why are you doing it? Which is also a major factor. But there is a basic spiritual poison. It's not a physical poison, but there's a basic spiritual poison in eating pigs. Whatever it represents, with the klipas, whatever it represents, there is a spiritual poison when you eat it. And you have basically, it's just the same thing. Let's say you took, there was a whole problem in Russia recently. After the aftermath of the meltdown at Chernobyl, there was radioactivity that was spewed and went into the water system, eventually went into the fruits and vegetables. And the fruits and vegetables were contaminated. You can't see it. I mean, now we have through a Geiger counter, you could tell about the radioactivity. But to the naked eye, this fruit looks just as good as any other fruit. And if I would point to you and I said, you know, don't eat that fruit. What do you mean? It's only superstitious, you know? Looks the same. All the same. We have Geiger counters to detect radioactivity. We haven't developed yet Geiger counters to detect spiritual pollution. But Kabbalistically, there's a spiritual pollution in consuming, you know, this type of food, or really anything. So really, when you have this world that God said, do this and don't do this, it's really, in a certain sense, I mean, again, it's only one part of an analogy, but just for educational means, it's really a map through a minefield. Like, don't step here, and don't step there, go here, there, this way, that way, until you reach the end. Because if you go to the right, or to the left, you'll be stepping on a mine. In that sense, spiritually, the Torah is, when it says, eat this and don't eat that, because spiritually it's stepping on a mine. So what happens if somebody does take in something which is radioactive and it causes some sort of damage? Well, it has to be eradicated. It has to be gotten rid of. Something, at least the damage has to be there. And if it And if it caused a cell to start mutating and become cancerous, now the cell has to be eradicated from the body. Radiation therapy for a cancer or chemotherapy is a means of refinement. It doesn't feel good, but that's the only way to get rid of the thing. In a certain sense, yesurin, suffering, is a means of refinement. We're not talking about the other R of retribution. We're talking about refinement. Another analogy, and again, we're just, it isn't exactly this, but, we're working around the idea, is that when a person takes, again, for this unique example here, takes chazer, this forbidden fruit, he really is a thief. So this is God's world. He had no right to go into it, to take it. And when he's taking something which the Torah said, don't touch, don't eat, he's really stealing. It would be akin of wrong to your friends, you're hungry, and you go to your friend's house, and the friend's in the back room, and you decide to help yourself. It's not just a great good thing. You want to help yourself to some of the food that's refrigerated. You empty out the whole refrigerator, and then finally the friend says, what are you doing? I'm hungry, so you should have asked me. After all, this is my refrigerator. We're friends, but not that close. Basically, the world is God's refrigerator. And he said, eat this, and I don't want you to touch this. And when you do, you're stealing. And when you've had forbidden pleasure, the only way to reverse the process is an equal amount of suffering, so to speak. And this, again, it's an analogy. But it's reversing the process. So one level of suffering is refinement. The first one was therapeutic, like the shock therapy. The second one was refinement. But there is another R, which is not refinement, but retribution. Because after all, besides dealing with Kabbalistic ideas and pollution or radioactivity, there's simply that it's an act of treason. Basically, again, we'll take another analogy. You happen to be in the army. You happen to be in the army. And you are given orders. And it's in the middle of a battle. And you refuse to follow through with the orders. The prisoner's just court-martialed. He's shocked. It's an act of treason. You're being part of the army means that you are under command of your commanding officer, and you have to follow orders. It's a dereliction of duty that the person is shocked. We are given 613 mitzvahs, or a non-Jew is given 7 mitzvahs, or whatever, general categories. And when he violates, it's a dereliction of duty. So there's one element which is a punishment. Give you an example. Let's say Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shemo. I don't think it's possible ever to refine the person. I would be very comfortable if he would be burning right now. How would we define that punishment? Like, basically, to relive all the suffering he caused to all those millions and millions of people. It's retribution. It's not refinement. It's not therapeutic. It's not refinement. It goes into another category. The difference between retribution and refinement, though, is that if, let's say, somebody sins without real bad cause. It was forgotten. It wasn't bad. It wasn't meant as a dereliction of duty. You didn't even know you had such a duty. Nothing of your fault. So then we're not dealing with retribution. We're dealing with refinement, with the kapkola. All of this, of course, is we're speaking about the person did not do teshuva. The person did not go through the self-refinement of changing, which is a tremendous chesed from Hashem, the tremendous grace of God that God will wipe, will refine by Himself if you let God. But if a person doesn't, then you have the other problem. And this is how you have a situation where the Gemara says in Bava Kamma and Daf Nun 50a, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Medakdek Imat Tzadikim Kechut HaSayra. Hashem is careful with the saints in terms of their punishment, their suffering, like the breath of a hair. As for any small infraction, there is the suffering. But as in this book, in Brian Weiss's book, he says that it's best for the person to suffer to get that refinement in this world, because if it's delayed into another world, the person, again, assuming it wouldn't be reincarnated or whatever it is, if it's in another world, then it seems to be of a much, much greater dimension, the type of suffering that exists in the other world. So it's looked in Jewish literature, it's looked that those who need refinement and have it in this world are ultimately better off, because upon death they immediately are embraced by the Shekhinah, as we described. And it's not just a temporary experience, like a momentary glimpse, but really it becomes a permanent experience. So the R, then the T is therapeutic, the R is refinement and retribution. U is understanding. Very often in life, we're very judgmental. Because you can't... there's in Pirkei Avos is the statement of Hillel, you shouldn't judge your friend until you reach his place. There's an American Indian saying, you can't judge your friend until you walk with his moccasins a mile. You can't... very often one develops a whole new understanding of life through suffering. So not just in the first the shock, to rethink about your whole life. But the whole situation gets you to understand. A person would never understand the plight of the street people, unless Rahmana Litzlan, he himself was forced into that situation of being homeless. And if a person had the callousness of not understanding, there's really no way in the world, very often, the person doesn't have that, there's no way of telling him about it or letting him read it unless he experiences it himself. It's very difficult to cap compassion if you're not suffering. There's a very famous story that's told about the Noidabi Yehuda, Rabbi Cheska Landau, who was the chief rabbi of Prague, Czechoslovakia, some 200 years ago. No longer Czechoslovakia. Czechland. As the story goes, or was him or another great rabbi, there was a need for, that the poor needed firewood for their homes. Just when it was a cold, the winter it turned very cold, and you don't appreciate it in Los Angeles. In Detroit, we appreciate it. It turned very cold in the winter. And he went to this wealthy man to try to get him to make a donation of firewood. So he knocked on the door. It was late at night, and the person was really in his bed clothes. And he called him, he knocked on the door, and you can see the scene, you know, the old bedclothes, you know, the person has the old cap, you know, and the gown, and it has this little, you know, this candle in the holder, and he's walking out, you know, and he knocks on the door, and he's all dreary-eyed, you know, and he sees the chief rabbi, and he says, "Rabbi, come in." He says, "No, I have to speak to you." You know, and the door is open, and the wind's blowing in, you know. And he's shaking his teeth, and his teeth are chattering, and he's shaking. He says, "You know, Rabbi, what is it you want?" He says, "You know," and he's taking his time, and he says, "You know, the poor people, you know, as you realize, it's a very cold winter, and you know, they really don't have, you know, enough firewood." So he says, "Firewood? You can take it all. I have more than enough." You know. And he gave him, I guess, what was necessary for the needs he felt of the poor people. Now, afterwards, the wealthy man asked the rabbi, and he said, "By the way, Rabbi, you could have walked in and you know, asked the same thing. It wouldn't have been the same. You wouldn't have understood how bad it is for these poor people." And very often, when we suffer, we gain new understanding. S is for self-inflicted. There are real sorrows in life, the real problems we have in life, and there are problems that are self-inflicted. A Jew's view, really this is very different than a pagan view. A Jew's view of life is that man is very, very important. In fact, man is why Hashem made the whole world, the whole universe. There's a Gemara in Brachos, Lama Beza, Lama Beza 32b, that there's a description of a conversation with the Jewish people and Hashem. And the Jewish people are complaining, "Hashem, you've forgotten us. You've forsaken us. We're in Golis, we're in diaspora, we're suffering, where are you?" And the Jewish, and God says, "How can I have forgotten about you? Look at those stars." And he lists the 12 zodiacs, you know, and there's stars beyond stars beyond stars that you can't see, and it comes into the trillions of stars, according to the calculations of the Gemara. I mean, it's an enormous number. "And you know what? I made all those stars just for the Jews, for Yisrael. And you tell me I forgot about you? Like, this is all for you. The whole world is for man. And man, therefore, is very chashuv. And anything that happens to man, let it be a tzora, let it be, is all part of God's plan. He didn't forget about you. He wanted you to have a tzora, the problem." There's a Gemara in Chulin and Zion on the base. 7b, it says, "Ain odem noikif etz boy milamata." Nobody stubs his finger below. "Elim ke nigzer ol milamayo," unless it's been decreed from above. You don't stub your finger unless it was the... There's a Tosfos in Avodah Zarah and Tazayin on the base in 16b, the quotes of Yerushalmi. Shimon bar Yochai, when he was, saw a someone who's trying to trap a fowler, someone who's trying to trap birds. And he heard a boskol, he heard a sound from heaven. And when the sound of heaven said, you know, there was an Aramaic word, it means "let him be saved," the fowler was unable to capture the bird. And when he heard a boskol, and he heard a sound from heaven say, "let it be trapped," then the trapper, the fowler, was successful. And the comment is, Rabbi Shimon said, you see, even a bird, what happens to that bird is dictated from heaven. Most certainly what happens to man. The Chofetz Chaim, in his classic work, the Yisroel Meir Kagan, who's one of the great scholars and saints of pre-World War II Europe, wrote about regarding the laws of Lashon Hara, speaking evil of others. This is his first work, about many, many other works afterwards, subsequently. But his first work, he describes as a very large work, but he describes in one part of it about why we have the the natia, the predisposition to speak lashon hara, to speak evil about people. And one major cause is because this guy hurt me, and I'm going to get evil with him because I hate him, because he's, my life would have been so much better if it wouldn't be for this person. And he just ruined my life. And he speaks about this idea of hatred. And the Holy Spirit explains, and based on quotes from other sources, that when a tzora, when Rachman Lusson, when some tragedy is destined to occur, it will happen no matter what. Let's say this person, in other words, this person was careless, you know, let's say your neighbor was careless and did something bad to you. Well, if it wouldn't be for your neighbor and he'd been more careful, if it was Bashert that something bad would have happened to you, then it wouldn't be from your neighbor, it would be some other thing. Lightning would have struck it. Your basement would be full of water, then you can't blame anybody. And you can't even sue because it may not have been covered in your insurance policy. Hashem has many ways of inflicting pain. The Megavgal and Choyv al Yedei Chayev. He causes the evil to be done by evil people. He gives them the first dib, so to speak. He gives them the opportunity of inflicting evil. If they refuse, well, they'll get somebody else to do it. But if anything, if that which happens bad, it's like stubbing one's finger. It was going to happen. It was part of the refinement or whatever the. When it goes into one of the categories of why it was bashert for the person to have that suffering. But it was going to happen in some form anyway. So the person who did it is a bad person. We're not talking about judgment. The person who did it, who was inconsiderate or evil, is a bad person. But if it wouldn't be for him, it would have happened anyway. So I could look at him in a objective sense and say, well, he's a bad person, he's a terrible person. But I don't have to put blame on him for all my suffering, because the suffering was inevitable. This is what the Chofetz Chaim explains. It reminds me of a very cute Hasidic tale. I don't know if this is true, but it's a beautiful story, and I have to share it with you. Two of the great early Hasidic masters were two brothers. They were Talmidim of the Rebbe Rebbeir, the Doiber Mizrich, Reb Zisha, says of Anapol, and Reb Elimelech of Luzhinsk. And in their younger years, they went into Golos. They went into self-imposed exile. And it was a matter of penance that they were heaped on, the abuse that's very often heaped on beggars. And part of it is the understanding. If you know what it means to be even a much more compassionate person. And they were going to this one little village, and while they were staying in the local inn, there was a robbery. And since they were the strangers, the finger was obviously pointed to them. So they were taken into a room by the townspeople. One of them was bound, Zisha was bound. Reb Elimelech was sitting on the floor on the side of the room, and they started hitting him and beating him and admit it. Because, you know, where is it? We know you stole it, admit it. Anyways, after some time of getting all this beating and abuse, there was some sounds outside. And it seems there was some wedding procession. So the people who were inflicting the tortures told them, says, you better, says, like this, if you leave this room, we really pity you. And they locked the room, and they went out for a short period of time. In the interim, the Rebbe Elimelech had pity on his brother who was being tortured. He says, listen, why should you undergo all this torture? He says, we're brothers, we look very similar, they won't tell the difference. I'll untie your knots, you know, that you're bound by. Says, I'll sit in your place, you tie me, then you'll be in the corner there. So I'll take the rest of the abuse. So Zisha consented, he followed his advice, he was untied, Reb Elimelech took his place, and now Reb Zisha is in the corner of the room where Elimelech is tied. The people now come back from this chasna, they come in, look at what's happening. Okay, it's enough with this guy, let's take the other guy now. And on this, Rav Zisha commented in Yiddish, Oib tzora zainan basher tzafar falen. In other words, if it's basher, it's as if it's fated, there should be tzora, so there should be suffering, you can't do anything about it. But what adds to our own problems when we have a tzora is all the angst we have and the hatred and all the emotions that it spews. But much of our suffering, like, is, you know, making mountain, is really a matter of making a mountain out of a molehill. Well, not saying in every case, but I'm just saying that there's a large portion of how we suffer. It's really self-inflicted. If we would have a different attitude of life, much of what we suffer would be alleviated. Because we would have trust. We wouldn't get lost. We wouldn't feel also that there's a sensitivity to tzoras. So if you have this high expectation of life, that life is supposed to get in this life, is supposed to be the place where you play solitaire on your computer. In other words, this is where you play. And not where you work. You're very disappointed when the boss sees you playing solitaire and slaps you on the hand. You know, gives you a browbeating. Because you thought that was your working conditions. I thought that's part of my contract. I'm allowed at least 10 hours every week of playing solitaire. But if you don't have those expectations, you don't feel bad of not having it. Everything, if it's good, it's good. Baruch Hashem. And if it's not, there's never really, the important thing is, what have I accomplished? What have I put into life, not what I've taken out of life? Which brings us really to the last of this part, which is test. Very often, the suffering itself is merely a test to see how we are going to react to that suffering. Are we going to compound it? How are we going to look at what's happening to us? There's a beautiful story. It's an apocryphal story, but which really puts it home, like the idea of what a test is. The story goes that a king had a loyal servant and sent him as an ambassador to a neighboring country. And the king warned him, as he charged him on his mission to be ambassador, he said, whatever you do, please, don't take off your shirt. Don't take off your shirt. A fair request. And he went on his mission as ambassador. Sometime later, he was called, he had an audience with the king of the neighboring country. And after they were speaking business, the king said, I didn't understand why that other king, and there's the other king, sent me an ambassador with a hunchback. He says, hunchback? I don't have a hunchback. Sure, you have a hunchback. No, I don't have a hunchback. Listen. I bet you $100,000 you have a hunchback. If you would only take your shirt off, I'll show you where your hunchback is. So the guy says, you knew he's not supposed to take his shirt off. He's not going to keep this $100,000 for himself. This will go back to the royal treasury. In fact, according to his rationale, he's doing really a service to the king by taking his shirt off. So he takes his shirt off. And he turns around, and the king says, you're right. I'm sorry. You don't have a hunchback. And took out $100,000 and gave it to the ambassador. Sometime later, that ambassador was recalled and had an audience with his own king. And he says, the king says, I told you not to take your shirt off. He says, yeah, but I think we made $100,000. He says, I bet that king $100 million you wouldn't take that shirt off. That's what a test is. very often in life, life is a test of how we're going to react. Are we going to lose ourselves, or are we going to take the attitude that it's Hashem's world, I'm only a guest here, I know He's taking care of me, and what happens, happens. And I would just like, the subject of suffering is a very lengthy one. We were supposed to start at 7, we started a little later, but I would really like to leave all unanswered areas, you know, to you, the audience, to ask. But I would like to end with a very precious story, again with the Rebbe Reb Zisha. The Rebbe Reb Zisha, we discussed two brothers who were Hasidim, Talmidim, disciples of the Rebbe Rebbeir, the second leader of the Hasidic movement. There were another two famous brothers. This was the Reb Pinchas Horovitz, the author of the Hafla, and Reb Shmuel, Reb Shmelka Horovitz, who became the chief rabbi of Nikolsburg. He's known as Reb Shmelka of Nikolsburg. But before they had their rabbinic positions, they were very close as students to the Rebbe Rebbeir, this founder. I mean, he was the second generation of the Hasidic movement. And they had a particular question that they had that was bothering them, that they wanted to ask their Rebbe. And what was it? There is a Mishnah in the last chapter of the tractate Brachos. This is the 9th chapter. This is Kishem. This is just like there's a Kishem Shemavorchen Ala Toiva, just we make a blessing on good, Tachmavorchen Ala Ra, we make a blessing on bad. The blessing is Baruch Dianemis, you know, he who is the rightful judge. Again, assuming again that the suffering does not just happen, but it's something that was ordained by Hashem. That's the substance of the Baruch. When something good happens, a birth in the family, windfall. There's another bracha, which is Baruch HaToy V'Hametiv. Blessed is he who is good and does good to others. So there are really two blessings, separate blessings. For good is HaToy V'Hametiv, who is good and does good. For the bad is Dayan Emes, the true judge. So the Gemara in Brachos and Afsama, asked the question, how could we say, Kishem Shemavorachan Ala Toiva, Kachmavorachan Ala Ra, just like we make a blessing for good, we make a blessing for bad, it's a different blessing. Not the same way. So the Gemara's answer is true, but the attitude should be the same. The tabulais is the simcha, to accept it with joy. Rashi doesn't explain it there, the idea of what it means accepting with joy. That would be another Rashi, in Erevin Mimalachom in Bezer 41b, in a similar situation, where he says that the joy or the acceptance is because the realization of this refinement. In other words, all suffering is basher, and if it's in God, evidently it was meant to be, and must have some therapeutic or refining element to it, and is accepted as such, and I know my life is in your hands, and I accept it. That's the simple meaning of the text. The two brothers, though, ask, that is true. But how could one accept it with the same joy? One could be philosophic about it. But how do you accept it with joy? With the simcha. So the Rebbe Rebbeir said, you know, it's a difficult question. The only one who could answer that question for you is the Rebbe Reb Zisha. He is the hero or whatever of the last story. They went to Reb Zisha to call his house a place of abject poverty would be a compliment. It was terrible. Something like Kobe after the earthquake. I mean, it was just terrible. And they went into him. First they have to, I guess, adjust their eyes to the dark. But they went into his home and they said, you know, the Rebbe sent us, And he explained the question, because just as you make a blessing for good, you make a blessing for bad. The Gemara says the same way is not the text, the formula of it, but the attitude, the kapula, the simple, accepted with joy. How could you have a joy when they're suffering? And Reb Zisha looked at them puzzled, and he says, I don't understand. What are you asking me for? I'm the least, the last person on earth you could ask such a question. I've never had a bad day in my life. Okay, are there any questions? Yes.
I just have a question. I gather that since suffering, if you don't get it in this world, would be more severe afterwards, that therefore most people get to suffer in this world. And the second part of the question is, does it also follow that the suffering that you get in terms of either refinement or retribution tends to more frequently follow the body you're in at the time as opposed to later on?
Okay. Let me answer the second question. One of the philosophical reasons why the theory of reincarnation, besides the evidence and besides the tradition, just the idea of rationally why it's so compelling, is the problem, why do small children suffer? What do they do wrong? Even if we say for this whole thing that has to do with sin, what do they do wrong? And the answer that really, this is in the arguments of the Eastern philosophers and the proponents of even Jewish sources, is because the idea of reincarnation is the only viable way of understanding the dynamics of suffering for children. That it must be that they're suffering, they're going through something relating to a past experience. Of course, it has to do also, any suffering impacts on the parents as well, which perhaps could be either past or present. But there is definitely suffering, at least from the sources, that is a past life, not just this life. And when you have a situation like children, it seems definitely to be related to past lives. I'd just like to share with you just the continuation of this. In this book, Many Lives, Many Masters, and this is the psychiatrist put this person under hypnosis and under regression, and she claimed to have vivid memories of past lives. He was really not convinced that it was really so. Maybe it was just a product of the patient's imagination. Until the following incident that shook him, and it seems, as he describes, really was the mark of a potash, was the final nail in the coffin, so to speak, that convinced him that we're dealing not with imagination or fantasization, but rather something that is real. This woman claimed in this book, I mean, according to the doctor, she claimed under hypnosis. That she was communicating with master spirits. The master spirits were communicating this enormous, important body of information to her. And the following is one incident which she describes under hypnosis of communication with the dead. So your father is here. This woman, who Dr. Weiss names Cat Culture by Catherine in the book, is a practicing Catholic. Simple woman. He never dealt with her on an intimate level, in other words, he had the correct relationship of a therapist.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.